Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
Donald Trump has been in office over 7 months. This hour, the challenges he's faced both domestic and abroad since our group last raised a glass in June. It's a special edition of River to River. It's Pints and Politics today, coming to you from Cedar Ridge Winery and Distillery in Swisher. I'm Ben Kiefer.
And I'm Aaron Jordan, Gazette reporter. All right, we're going to introduce our panelists here. We've got, on the left, we've got Gazette editorial page editor and columnist Todd Dorman. Gazette columnist Linda Waddington. And Gazette political reporter James Lynch. So we're going to start off tonight, as we usually do, talking about some national issues. But there's not much to talk about, right? All right. Well, the big issue of the week and the last couple weeks has been Tropical Storm Harvey and the impact that's caused on that Gulf Coast region there, but also how that has affected our nation politically. There's been a lot of talk about President Trump's response to the storm down there and all the flooding. How do you think that accepting aid from Mexico affects President Trump's campaign to have Mexico help pay for the border wall?
I don't think the promise was we'll flood Houston and have Mexico pay for it, but I think it was a nice gesture on the part of Mexico, and I think the president is probably right to sort of meet that gesture with some acceptance and take that aid. There's a lot of debate right now. You know, is the president's response adequate? Is it? I think it's a little early to tell. We're in the early stages. There's been a lot of rescue and response to the disaster itself. Now we're going to go on recovery, which is anyone who lives in the Cedar Rapids area knows that's sort of the long road when the media goes home and you have to do sort of the rebuilding and you have people applying for government assistance, and that can be difficult. So I think that's going to be the true test going forward of whether his response has been adequate. And of course, there's the broader view of talk about whether this hurricane was, or any hurricane, is intensified by climate change. And I think on that issue, the president has in the eyes of folks like myself who think climate change is real, has sort of dropped the ball, pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord, has called climate change a hoax.
Yeah, go ahead, Linda.
I was just going to say, I hope what comes out of this, if nothing else good can come out of this, I hope it's that we finally see Congress getting on the same page with disaster assistance and disaster aid. We saw those political games being played after Hurricane Sandy. I really hope we don't see those again with Hurricane Harvey, not the least of which because I have family in the direct path of Hurricane Harvey. So this has been a little bit of apprehensive and touch and go week in our household, worrying about family and friends there. But when people are hurting, our nation needs to come together, and that's not something that we have seen previously. We've seen holdouts for various reasons, and let's just stop the games. Do your riders on other bills, make political hay with other bills, but don't do it when we're talking directly about these lives who have lost everything.
There you go. Before we go to James Lynch for your comments, I wanted to sort of poll the audience with an applause poll based on this flooding. How many, and applaud if this is true of you, have been your family, yourself, or friends been personally impacted by significant flooding in the past? Okay. And how many of you have family or friends in the affected area now dealing with this disaster? Okay, so we have a significant number. This is something that binds our nation together. You talked about these periods of when we can, we don't know how many days it will last, put partisan politics and aside and like a fresh breath of air, sort of feel feel unity in this. James, your observations about the past few days of reaction to this disaster?
Well, I think, as we see in most of these disasters, whether it was here, the flooding here in 2008 or other disasters, people pull together, people put aside differences. It strikes me funny in a way that we have to say, you know, the flood knows no politics. Well, duh. you know, it seems obvious. But I think it is a moment where people are putting aside differences and reacting to a bigger crisis than whether or not people are Democratic or Republican or what their political beliefs or who they voted for president. You know, you can't help, as you look at the pictures from Houston, be reminded of what Cedar Rapids and Iowa City looked like back in 2008. It was just sort of heartbreaking looking at the pictures from the Houston Chronicle this morning, the aerials of the town just completely underwater. So I think, you know, here we have a lot of empathy for the folks in Houston who, I just want to point out, voted for Hillary Clinton overwhelmingly.
I noticed that too. Yeah, I was going to ask, you know, so in 2008, President Bush came to Cedar Rapids and I think visited an emergency shelter and maybe came into the Iowa City area, into a neighborhood, and actually talked with people who had been victims of that flooding. And there was some criticism of President Trump that he didn't actually meet with victims when he was there. James, how important is it to people who experience this and who are maybe voters going forward to have that personal connection?
Well, I think we're at the point in this disaster where the optics maybe are more important than what the president can do. I mean, FEMA and those agencies know what needs to be done. The president needs to be there to console people, to give them confidence that the federal government is going to be there for them. I think he's going back to Houston tomorrow or Saturday, if I remember correctly. It'll be interesting to see if he sort of does the goes to the shelters, goes to some of those, you know, emergency command centers, those sorts of things. You know, I mean, part of it is politics. It's, you know, you want to be seen in those places. It gives the nation confidence in your leadership.
I mean, it's damned if you do and damned if you don't, if you're the president. Presidents don't get to come in their own little car and drive up to the, you know, the emergency shelter and just go in and visit with people. I mean, they come with a huge entourage. So I'm rather thankful that President Trump decided to stay kind of out of the main mix of it for now. There's plenty of time for him to come in later. I'm very happy with the response that he and Vice President Pence are giving now.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the other things that have happened since we last had a chance to gather here on Pints and Politics. White nationalist violence became a national issue a few weeks ago since that rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, in which an anti-racism activist was killed when a suspected white nationalist rammed the car into counter-demonstrators, killing one person, injuring, I think, 19. Following that violence, the president was roundly criticized, also from his own party, for failing to single out the white nationalists for condemnation. And in the words of the president, that stuck, that he didn't choose to repeat, all sides were to blame. Then we have more recently, last weekend, a largely peaceful demonstration in Berkeley was disrupted by black-clad Antifa counter-protesters who jumped over barricades to attack right-wing, perhaps supremacist demonstrators there. I'm wondering, now that's been a bit overshadowed by the hurricane disaster and discussion about that, what do you think of the national discussion that those episodes and our president's reaction to them has set off here in the country? What has it revealed to you, panel?
Well, I think a number of things. One, the sort of a deep divide between people who really don't have any problem with these monuments to the Confederacy and people who find them offensive in a way that I think many of us, if we've grown up in the upper Midwest,
don't find offensive. We weren't part of the Confederacy. We weren't part of the reason, really, that war was fought. I think it's hard for us to kind of get our heads around the very visceral reaction some people have to monuments to the Confederacy. I don't think we can erase our past. At the same time, I don't know that we put up monuments to traitors.
And there are at least several Confederate tributes here in Iowa that were raised even in the early 2000s, early to mid 2000s. So it's not like these monuments are that old. So people have support for some of those.
Yeah, there are a couple. There's one that is a memorial to a Confederate general who lived in Iowa at one time. And there's one to, the northernmost battle in the Civil War was fought in
Davis County.
Davis County,
Bloomfield,
yeah.
Bloomfield.
Very southern Iowa. So there's a marker or a monument to that, which really doesn't seem like it's a monument to the Confederacy so much as just a historical fact.
You know, in terms of the, the movement that's kind of spawned some of these events, I know there's another one that's scheduled, kind of a white nationalist event scheduled for D.C. on September 16th called the Mother of All Rallies. So, there after those events, Steve Bannon was stepped out as chief political strategist at the White House. Do you think, I don't know if Todd or Linda want to take this one, just whether that move has caused distance between that movement and President Trump, or whether you think there's significance there?
I don't think so from the standpoint that, the problem that Donald Trump had with the Charlottesville incident is, of course, part of it was that he didn't respond right away, and when he did, he blamed many sides, and then he sort of tried to, on the Monday, had a better statement, and then on Tuesday had a press conference where he sort of wiped that out. But I think the problem for him is that, why people wanted him to speak was not just because it was a horrific act of basically domestic terrorism. A person was killed. But that his campaign had sort of capitalized on this idea that, what's wrong with the country is that white guys aren't in charge anymore. The immigration is a problem. Affirmative action is keeping your kids out of college. Quotas are keeping you from getting a job. There's just all sorts of these things, all sorts of these sort of points of anger that he capitalized on. He sort of ripped the scab off a lot of scars. And now, there wouldn't have been a Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville without Donald Trump. He's invigorated this movement. So when this happened, when someone was killed, when there was violence, he had probably more of an onus to sort of say the right thing because of his status, what his campaign stood for, and he whiffed. He dropped, and I don't think firing Steve or persuading Steve Bannon to pursue other interests, solves the problem. When Barack Obama had an issue with the Reverend Wright, when other presidents have had these big sort of clouds hanging over their presidency, they give a speech or they do something. And Donald Trump hasn't done that with white supremacy and this pot that he's stirred up. He has not stepped forward to respond to that problem in a way that has given people confidence that he actually sees it as a problem.
And as someone who grew up in the South and someone who has family who way back when was part of the Confederacy, those scabs never formed. And that's something I don't think here in Iowa that Iowans really understand, is that that has been churning and churning and kind of being angry and underneath the surface ever since then. It hasn't been resolved. It hasn't been healed, definitely. And there are things that this president has said during his campaign, during his presidency, that have absolutely emboldened those individuals. And you don't have to take my word for it. I was actually reading an interview with a former white supremacist in a publication, a business publication. So we're not talking politics necessarily here, but just information. And this former white supremacist is saying that it wasn't a dog whistle, what Donald Trump did for these groups. It was a bullhorn. And I realize There are people on the left who are doing things that I don't agree with, who are responding to these things in ways that I would not do it. But even if that is happening, that does not erase exactly who Nazis are and what Nazis did and what the KKK did and what they stood for. And we need a president who will get up unequivocally, not come out the day before and the day after and change his mind and say that we will not have people preaching hate in the streets of America, period.
We're at Cedar Ridge Winery and Distillery in Swisher, Iowa, for this edition of Pints and Politics on River to River, together with the Gazette, Iowa Public Radio, partnering up for these, approximately once a month discussions to chew over the latest on the political landscape. Still on the national questions here, on our panel, you just heard Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, and James Lynch, my co-host here, Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. Let's go to a question here, Aaron, if we could, because this question from one of our audience members dovetails nicely into one of the points we wanted to talk about, which is the question here, are there new developments in the Mueller investigation that have been overshadowed by Hurricane Harvey? And indeed there have. We heard in the last few days that a business associate of the president promised in 2015 to engineer a real estate deal with the aid of President Putin of Russia. He said this would help Donald Trump with his presidency. What is the quote we pulled out of this? Our boy can become president of the USA and we can engineer it. This is the business associate writing to Michael Cohen, a close attorney of the president here. Other facets of the Russia probe unfolding. Where do we stand right now? Any thoughts from our panel on the Mueller investigation?
Well, when the Senate comes back into session next week, there's going to be a closed session hearing with both Paul Manafort and Donald Trump Jr., and then transcriptions will be released. Robert Mueller also has brought in the New York Attorney General into the investigation, which is sort of an interesting development because whatever Trump does, if he would decide to fire Mueller, he can't fire the New York Attorney General. So by linking to the New York Attorney General, I guess the investigation could continue whether Trump fire somebody or not. So yeah, it's really been overshadowed by Harvey, which I guess is appropriate, but it's still there and it's still proceeding.
Well, and just as a happy coincidence, Chuck Grassley chairs the intelligence, or the committee,
Judiciary
Committee that's gonna be doing that closed door session, and the president just happened to call him and just make sure he let him know that he really loves ethanol and he's gonna continue to support ethanol. So that was mighty nice of the president, I thought.
Oh, and by the way.
Hey, Chuck, what are you up to?
Another question from the audience here. It kind of talks about the issues about the border walls and folks moving here with not documents and families being subject to deportation. I know I was listening to National Public Radio on my drive up here, and they were talking a little bit about how the president is expected in coming days to make a decision about DACA, which allows children of illegal immigrants to stay here and keep doing what they're doing. But this person here was saying that, he is a legal resident and, doesn't want the process subverted by, folks who maybe come here without proper documentation. Linda, I don't know if you have any thoughts about this, about what should happen here. It's a very fraught situation.
You know, we have this very interesting situation with the Dreamers or the DACA recipients in that they have no path forward. They can't be necessarily skilled workers. They can't take a family sponsorship. They're already here. And many of them came here when they were infants or 3 years old or 10 years old or however old. But there's no path forward for them. So if DACA goes away, they leave. And once they are deported, that's a strike against them and they can't come back. So, and I was listening to the same report actually on NPR, and the situation was, if Democrats agree to fund money for the border wall, would Trump then agree to codify DACA into law? So, I mean, that's kind of what's on the table now. And I think maybe that's a conversation that we need to have, because it's not a conversation this nation has had before. And are these individuals valuable to us as a country? And, you know, do we want to keep them here? And if we do, how do we do that constitutionally, I think is the question that we have now.
Once again, our immigration law makes no sense. I mean, these people are here of their no fault of their own. You know, some of them have lived their basically their entire lives here, and to tell them, you know, you have to leave, it's like, but this is home. You know, it's and this situation has really dragged on. I mean, for years. How long ago was it that? You know, there was an attempt, the Gang of Eight tried to rewrite immigration policy to, you know, so that we could get beyond the situation we are now, and there just is not political support to do that, and very little leadership to address the situation. I mean, I think it's perfectly logical for people to say that a nation should control its borders. But on the other hand, I don't know what the logic is that says somebody who's lived their whole life here should be sent somewhere else just because their parents came here illegally.
I try to keep my finger on the pulse of like current trends, and I think border walls are out and flood walls are in. That's all I know right now. I think that's what we need.
It's a special edition of River to River, Pints and Politics today, coming to you in a session recorded at the Cedar Ridge Winery and Distillery in Swisher, Iowa, on a beautiful evening. The sun is setting. We're halfway through with my co-host Aaron Jordan of the Gazette, along with political reporter James Lynch, Linda Waddington, and Todd Dorman, columnist of the Gazette. A wonderful crowd out here on this beautiful evening. We'll be back in just a moment with more of Pints and Politics on River to River. Coming up in just a moment, we shift our attention to state politics. That's as River to River continues on Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
I'm Ben Kiefer.
And I'm Aaron Jordan.
All right, we have our panelists. Want to reintroduce them. James Lynch, columnist. Linda Waddington, also columnist. James Lynch, rather, political reporter. Is there a hierarchy there? Do you kind of place one above the other?
They're much higher.
Yeah. He doesn't want to be called a columnist. I mean, that's bad luck.
Todd Dorman, Linda Waddington, columnist with the Gazette, along with James Lynch. And this half hour, before an audience of a couple hundred here on the beautiful winery here in eastern Iowa as the sun sets, we want to delve more into state politics, Aaron Jordan.
That's right. So we've been hearing this week, I know the Gazette reported that Governor Reynolds has said she'll decide in September whether she's going to need to call a special legislative session to decide what our revenue picture's like and whether we're going to need additional cuts because of the lower than expected taxes coming in. And so she can transfer $50 million on her own, but if it's more than that, she's going to need to call a special session. So I wanted to ask our panelists, and I don't know if James, if you want to jump in, You know, what's the political cost to Governor Reynolds if she has to call a special session, and what might you expect on the chopping block?
Well, you know, I think if she's smart, she's going to point out that she didn't create this mess, that she, it was sort of in the welcome wagon basket when she got to the Capitol. But she can try. But yeah, there's cost. And I mean, part of it is, you know, coming from His Honor Ron Corbett, who keeps pointing out, you know, that she's borrowing more money than big debt Chet, which is causing some consternation among Republicans, but I'm sure Democrats are loving it because it's writing the playbook for them after the primary next June for what they can, you know, the campaign they can run against her. You know, I talked to her yesterday, and she still says, well, she doesn't think they're going to need a special session, but I'm not quite sure how she's going to avoid one.
Tomorrow is September.
Yeah.
So we'll know tomorrow.
No, the books close at the end of the month.
Oh.
So they won't know until then. So, yeah.
Well, and refusing to call a special session would even make her more like big debt Chet, because after the flood of 2008, he refused to call a special session.
Yeah.
So the Culver comparisons keep coming, which I don't think is obviously a good omen for your governorship.
No, not at all. No.
So they, you know, there's this backfill, $150 million or so dollars that are offsetting the losses from property taxes from 2013. Do you guys think that's something that's on the chopping block, or what else might we see?
Well, historically, when the legislature has faced a decision of whether they're going to suffer pain or whether local governments are going to suffer pain, they tend to sort of roll the pain downhill. So I mean, they made this promise, and Governor Branstad was very adamant that they would honor that promise. But there's, you know, there's a new governor, and I'm not sure, backed into a corner, facing more cuts and kind of fundamental things that people want government to do. If you have more cuts like that, bad optics, I mean, if you're faced with that or telling local governments they need to tighten their belt, I think in the end that's what you may do, which honestly would be, in some cases, from a budget standpoint, catastrophic for a lot of local governments.
And that backfill to lower commercial property taxes and to switch multifamily dwellings to residential units was never meant to go on forever. I mean, it was only a five-year backfill, so it's going to expire anyway. Isn't that right?
And I think it's worth noting that, as Todd alluded to, that we have a new governor. The people who were really responsible for that commercial property tax cut, Governor Branstad, Senate Majority Leader Mike Gronstall, and House Speaker Craig Paulson, are all gone. None of them are involved in this debate today. So the champions of that have moved on. And I think you're right that maybe the people who are involved in the discussion today don't have as much ownership of the property tax cut as those folks.
And that was always the sort of the secret of that property tax reform plan that was bipartisan, as James alluded to, was that you created a property tax system that no longer adequately funds local government. So then you had to have this massive, you know, $275, $300 million pot of backfill each year to sort of make the system work. Well, I mean, now I think the discussion needs to be, how do we create a tax system that allows local governments to operate? What other sources of revenue could they potentially tap? The legislature's never been very willing to sort of let local governments have other ways of raising taxes. They want it to just be property taxes, and then they control income and all of those other things. But I think that discussion, if you're going to get rid of the backfill, you inevitably, I think, unless you're just irresponsible, you have to give local governments other options for raising revenue, and none of that's going to be easy. Then you layer that on top of what do you do with the state tax system. There's a lot of talk of reforming that. I mean, these are sort of big, big, complex issues that they're dealing with, and it's an election year, and I don't know how much progress they're actually going to make.
You know, and beyond that, we look at these property tax cuts, and the reason that we did it was because we were saying that we're going to make Iowa more attractive to businesses. But yet here we had to give $200 million for an Apple data center with 50 jobs. You know, we said we were going to do these, move these multifamily apartment dwellings at the lower residential rate because that would trickle down to those residents and they would get lower rents. Has anybody had their rent lowered? Their rent lowered?
The rent's too damn high.
Yeah.
But here we are 5 years later, and now we're saying, oh, we need a new system, and we need to give local governments the ability maybe to raise different types of taxes. Maybe we should determine and have some accountability on if the tax cuts we've already given have provided the results we said we wanted.
You seem to be mind-melding with many, some at least, who are in our audience. I've got a couple questions exactly on that point. What's the story with the $200 million tax credit for a 50-employee Apple plant, a data center? Am I missing something, asks this audience member. Another question along those lines, how long will it take Iowa to recover from the tax credit hole this state is in? Todd Dorman, you wrote, I believe, recently in your column about this Apple data center.
I think it's if you look at this, I mean, what the legislature does a lot of times is an interest group comes, say, I don't know, aircraft manufacturers or massage therapists or any of these kind of businesses, and they say, we want to be exempted from sales tax, or we want to have the equipment we use to make something exempt from property tax. And in and of themselves, it doesn't seem like a big deal. Well, it's, you know, it's a few million dollars here, a few million dollars there. It's a good company. It's a good interest. But, you know, the Department of Revenue does a study every 4 years. And if you look at all of those tax credits and exemptions, and then the big added in with, like, the bigger tax cuts, your income tax cuts way back in 1998, I believe, or 99, and some of that stuff, I mean, you've got $12 billion in revenues that are sort of don't come in every year because we've done these tax cuts. Now, you know, some of those are good, some of those are bad, although there's precious little information on what the actual impact of a lot of that stuff is, whether it actually lived up to the glossy sort of promises that were made when it was passed. But over time, when you keep giving all of those chunks away for all of these, you know, well-meaning things, you get to a point where you can't afford to give public schools more than 1.1%. You have to raise tuition on college, on, you know, state university students. As I mentioned earlier, you can't send, the ombudsman can no longer afford to send people to visit nursing homes. You can't clean up water. I mean, there are just all sorts of things suddenly that you can't make investments in, sort of basic stuff that government is supposed to do in a lot of ways, because the revenue is to the point where it's no longer growing because you've taken so many scoops out of it. Now, I'm not saying that there's no spending that can be cut, that there's no, that the budget is pristine and that there's no waste, fraud, abuse, whatever is the sort of the catchphrase you hear, but at some point you need to stop giving things away. And I think what's happened with this Apple thing is that the public, a lot of people have sort of started to realize that. So when this Apple deal came out with a company that productive, it's sort of the cherry on top of the sundae. I think people are starting to say, maybe this is enough.
Special edition of River to River, Pints and Politics, coming to you from Cedar Ridge Winery and Distillery in Swisher. Todd Dorman, Linda Waddington, James Lynch of the Gazette, and my co-host here, Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. Aaron, you've got a follow-up there.
So, Cedar Rapids Mayor Ron Corbett wanting to run for governor, he's been poking, as James alluded to a little bit, Governor Reynolds about this budget situation. But he also made a big announcement recently that he thinks that the State Board of Regents should be abolished and that each of the three state public universities have their own governing boards. I wanted to ask the panel what you think about that idea.
I think it's probably a non-starter. There's just institutional inertia when it comes to abolishing the Board of Regents. Jack Hatch, 4 years ago, 3 years ago, whenever, proposed replacing, he was going to have a chancellor that would sort of be the go-between the legislature and the Board of Regents.
It didn't go anywhere. And I don't see this idea going anywhere and unless he can explain what the advantage is. And so far, I really haven't heard what the advantage is to having replacing the Board of Regents with three boards of trustees.
And I think one of the, maybe not the stated mission, but one of the practical results of the Board of Regents is to keep this the state's three big public institutions, UNI, ISU, and UI, kind of on the same page and kind of going in the same direction. I think that might have made sense several years ago. I'm not sure if that makes sense going into the future. If we went with a trustee system, granted, that would allow tuitions to vary between the different institutions, but it also might allow more variation between the three institutions that might better serve Iowa students. So I'm in favor of at least exploring the idea. I'm not 100% on board yet, but I think there might be merits there that just because we've never had that, we don't necessarily realize it.
Well, and one thing worth mentioning is I think it's at least worth looking at from the standpoint that, and universities are much different, but I mean, probably the most beloved part of our higher education system are community colleges, mm-hmm. and they're each run by a board of trustees. And they seem to be able to carry out their mission effectively and efficiently in a lot of ways. So whenever you've got a situation where you can't afford the government you have, I think that's worth exploring whether you change. And I mean, the regents have a $4 million budget. And I mean, they're sort of, they exist to sort of govern. They don't teach students. They're sort of bureaucracy in its purest form. And so, you know, it's a sort of question whether we need that is probably healthy. But I think James is right. I don't know that that goes anywhere because, I mean, the regents have some clout. And I mean, it's a system that we've had for an awfully long time.
There's also been proposals in the past that the community colleges should be overseen by the Board of Regents. There's been that proposal out there. And the other thing is that whatever form of governance you have, whether it's trustees, a chancellor, a Board of Regents, it still depends on state support for the institutions. If the state isn't going to support the institutions, it doesn't matter who's in charge or what form it is, you're going to have problems.
Let's go to another question. A couple of questions from our audience members touching on, you mentioned Ron Corbett. This questioner asks, does Ron Corbett really have a chance? Other questioner says, let's compare the candidates for governor, please. How many do we have out there? Ron Corbett challenging in the primary, Governor Kim Reynolds on the Democratic side. Talk about each side and what's happening. What do you see happening?
How many?
Seven Democrats,
three Republicans. A libertarian and an independent, and who knows who else is out there.
And a partridge in
a pear tree.
Tree,
yes. Yeah.
Does Ron Corbett have a chance?
That was one question here from our audience, yes.
I mean, as of today at, 6:44 p.m., no. But it's the end of August. I mean, the primary is in June. We talked about the budget problems. There are a lot of landmines out there for Kim Reynolds, and depending on how she handles that stuff, and I mean Ron Corbett, he's been around politics. I mean he's politically savvy. He's run successful campaigns, so it's hard to count him out at this point. But I mean she's got the establishment. She's going to have a huge financial advantage. Republicans right now are willing to very much overlook any blemishes if they think they can win. I mean, I think we saw that with the Trump campaign. The challenges for him are formidable, but it's early to say that he's got absolutely no chance and won't have any chance going forward, but it's tough.
Today there is a new Twitter account, Wrong Corbett, that launched by supporters of Kim Reynolds, who called Ron Corbett idiotic and hypocritical. So we can see that this is going to be a nice campaign,
Well, they stole his high school nickname because that was his high school nickname, Ron Corbett, because his coach, he kept using the wrong foot to go up for a layup. They call them wrong. I mean, can you really steal someone's high school nickname and campaign against them with it? I mean, that's a new low, I think. I think we've gone too far now. At long last.
Let's hear a little bit more about the Democratic side. Governor, our last Democratic governor in Iowa, Chet Colbert, losing to Governor Branstad upon his return to public service as a governor. What will it take for the Democrats to... What kind of Democratic candidate, let's say this way, has a chance to win back the governorship?
I don't think any that are currently on the ballot. I think the Democrats are still grappling with who they are and how they want to approach this, and until they get kind of where they need to be and are able to make that valid campaign, I just don't see those campaigns going anywhere, which is unfortunate because they have some really talented individuals and some people really committed to Iowa. I mean, you look at John Norris and his experience level, who would be excellent here in Iowa, and Fred Hubble with his business experience. But I don't see anyone really breaking that barrier they need to break to become a household name yet.
It's early. It's early.
Oh, I should have started with that.
Yeah.
You should have just said that.
It's early. But I agree with Linda that nobody has broken out, and I think it's going to depend perhaps on circumstances who breaks out. Right now, as we've talked about before, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party maybe is in ascendancy. It's energized. It's enthusiastic. I'm not sure that that's the agenda that's going to win the governor's race, though. I mean, when you look at the governors we've elected in the past, Iowans haven't really gone for someone who's championing same-sex marriage, someone who's championing $15 an hour minimum wage, someone who champions that progressive agenda. So while you may be able to get the nomination, I'm not sure that's going to be a winning nomination in Iowa. But I go back to what I started with. It's early.
Quickly, before we end up, we have to talk about fireworks new law. we probably should ask our audience before our panelists kind of weigh in on this. You know, as the law is in Iowa now, legalizing fireworks, and the different municipalities taking different approaches to how they are legalized here. How many think that the legislature got it right in the present form of legalizing fireworks? Clap if you think that. How many would like to see some significant amendments in the way we deal with fireworks? I have to say that my dog, who was cowering in the basement for most of the end of June and into July, would agree with our audience here. What does the panel say about what we're likely to see, perhaps in the 2018 legislative session, enough blowback that they're going to be sort of a reshaping of this fireworks law? Or is it going to be done on a local level?
I mean, they gave local governments the ability to restrict use. We're seeing a lot of bans pass, so I think that's happening. The sale is going to remain legal. I would be surprised if the legislature touches it.
If the legislature does anything, based on their track record, they're going to preempt local decision-making and say, you have to allow it. You have to allow fireworks to be shot off, be exploded. I mean, that's the track record of this legislature, is to preempt local control.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think we've seen in the past what does work in Iowa, and that's the legislature being very choosy about what types of fireworks are sold and accepted in the state. And they've kind of blown it pretty much wide open, except for a few very noisy exceptions, I guess is the best word. But other states have been able to whittle that down a little bit more and come up with something that doesn't cause the massive consternation, I think, that we sound this last. So if the legislature does decide to go back into it, I hope they go back into it not necessarily from a standpoint of completely banning or reducing the window, but maybe reducing the types of fireworks that are allowed for sale in Iowa. Yeah. And I think that would work.
Well, I think we're going to leave that here for tonight, but on behalf of the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio, we want to thank the Cedar Ridge Winery and Distillery and also our sponsor, Fairfax State Savings Bank, for having us out tonight.
Pints and Politics, recorded yesterday evening at Cedar Ridge Winery and Distillery in Swisher. Our producer and audio editor today, Catherine Perkins. Sound engineer, Jim Davies. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us, and have a fabulous Labor Day weekend.